everybody. I am so excited to be back here for our 18-19 school year for School Psych Podcast. My name is Rachel. I'm a school psychologist working in Maryland. Before we get started, because I know we have like a jam-packed, information-filled episode tonight with lots of really good stuff, but a couple of things. One, I wanted to tell you guys to check out our promo video if you didn't already, just for the 18-19 school year. We had a lot of fun making that. It was kind of a goofy thing. The other thing is you're going to notice that Anna is not here. I'm not sure if we talked about this in a prior episode, but Anna has decided to go on a bit of a hiatus, just from life. And, you know, she's got kids and Girl Scouts and all sorts of different things going on that she's a part of. So she's stepped back for a little bit, but she's still super awesome, still my best friend. So we're hoping that maybe we can, you know, wrangle her back in for maybe some episodes at some point. But right now she's kind of taking a little bit of a break. But luckily we have awesome Eric to step in and fill a more, you know, a more permanent type position. Eric, I'm hoping you're more permanent and you're not going to... But so we're super excited for that because, as you guys know, Eric's been doing a lot of episodes with us and has just been an awesome contributor to the podcast, as well as the you know, School Psych of the Year in Connecticut. So yay for Eric. But yeah, I'm going to pass it over to Rebecca now, who's going to tell us how to participate. So, Rebecca.
Hi, everybody. I'm really excited to be back for another season of Psych Podcast. And many of you who are watching live will already know that probably the easiest way to participate is to comment right along the YouTube video. You do have to sign in to YouTube in order to be able to comment, but we'll be looking for questions, ideas, thoughts, comments there. And you can also comment on Facebook and on either Facebook page, School Psych, Your School Psychologist, or the School Psych Podcast page. And that you can do now if you're watching live, or later, even after the broadcast, because we will continue the conversation after we go off air. And then also on Twitter using the hashtag Psyched Podcast. So thank you so much for being here. And here's Eric to kick off our poll.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm super excited as well. Beginning of our season, so we have a wonderful lineup, and this evening we have a fantastic speaker and discussion ahead regarding English language learners and assessment and some things to consider. And we did a poll, and we had quite a few responses. The poll question was, when evaluating English language learning students, which of the following would I use or consider? And we had 86 responders who said they use BICS or CALP. They consider BICS or CALP in their assessment. 86 responders also give a nonverbal measure of cognitive development. 72% of the people said they involve English language learning teachers or English as a second language teachers in their process. 54% on that have testing native language when appropriate. Two people just has a bilingual available or content. The school says is not bilingual. We had 32, they used Dr. Ortiz. 29.
A little bit, Eric.
Yeah.
What's that?
You're breaking up a little bit, but I hear you now. So, yeah. How many for Dr. Ortiz's matrix?
32 for the C. And 12 use translator when needed. 28 people said they're comfortable testing ELL students. And 26 people said more often than not, they don't have appropriate resources for testing ELL students, and 6 people responded that they're not comfortable at all testing ELL students. Obviously, getting the most accurate and comprehensive assessment for any student is really crucial for what we do with assessments. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Ortiz, who's going to discuss this with us. And I have to say, before I read Dr. Ortiz's bio, just that his name has come up in many conversations that I've had with school psychologists at NASP, at Connecticut State Association, CASP. So he's well known in the field, As well as through my school neuropsych program as well. He's been a contributor and speaker through that program too. So I'm excited to hear what he's going to talk with us about. Dr. Ortiz is a professor of psychology at St. John's University. He holds a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Southern California and is credentialed in school psychology with postdoctoral training in bilingual school psychology from San Diego State University. He served as a visiting professor and research fellow at Nagoya University in Japan, vice president of professional affairs for APA Division 16, school psychology, as member and chair of APA's Committee on Psychological Testing and Assessment, member of the Coalition of Psychology in Schools and Education, as representative of New York State Committee of Practitioners on ELL and LEP students, and as a member of the APA Task Force on Educational Disparities. He serves or has served on various editorial boards, including the Journal of School Psych, School Psych Quarterly, Journal of Applied School Psychology, and is a member of the Society of Study of School Psychology, SSSP. Dr. Ortiz has published widely on a wide range of topics and is a frequent presenter at professional conferences, as well as internationally recognized expert on issues involving non-discriminatory assessment, evaluation of English learners, cross-battery assessment, and specific learning disabilities. He is the author of the new Ortiz Picture Vocabulary Acquisition Test, or PVAT, and is the first test, which is the first test with dual norms designed specifically for English learners and English speakers. I'm excited to hear a little about that tonight if we have time. He's primary co-author of the XBAS cross-battery software system and the Cultural Interpretive Language Matrix, the CLIM. And his books include Assessment of Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Students, A Practical Guide, which is currently under revision, and Essentials of Cross-Battery Assessment, third edition. Dr. Ortiz is bilingual Spanish and bicultural Puerto Rican. Welcome, Dr. Ortiz.
Thank you very much, Eric. I'm going to make my screen active here and want to make sure everybody can see it before I start off. So you let me know if it looks good.
Yes.
All right. Are we on? All right. Well, yeah. Buckle up, everybody, because we got a lot to cover, not a whole lot of time. And boy, is this a topic that I've wanted to do, especially in this kind of format, for a very long time. Very informal, but also instructive. And I think, Eric, the results of the poll that you were mentioning were very enlightening, because it shows precisely what a mess we actually have when it comes to evaluating English learners. And that's nothing new. I recognize this as a mess when I started in school psychology, and I was asked to evaluate an English learner, and I thought it was an easy solution. Just go find the book, find the framework, find the standards. There you go. You do it. What else? You know, how hard could it be? That was 25 years ago. And not a lot has actually happened since then that has made that decision easier. And I have a picture here, as you can see on my initial slide, which I think captures the obstacle that people face when it comes to working with an English learner. And what you have here is basically a sign in a produce section that says banana 69 cents a pound. But you're looking at the fruit behind there and you're thinking to yourself, those are some funny looking bananas, okay? So you have a decision to make. Do you look at that sign and do you say to yourself, okay, you know what? I believe the sign. It's valid. So I'm buying those fruit. I'm taking them home, making my banana cream pie and wondering why the heck it doesn't taste right. Or you say, no, I don't care what that sign says or how authoritative it might be. It's not valid. Those are not bananas. I'm not going to believe it. I'm not going to be taken in by it. And I'm not going to buy them. And that is the essential concept of validity when you give any test to an English language learner. Is the result that you got, is the score, which was designed to measure a particular domain like bananas, well, not really like bananas, but like, you know, visual processing, auditory processing, whatever. Is it really a measure of that ability, or is it, in fact, the measure of something else, like the child's limited English comprehension? And that is the decision that you must make. Every single evaluator has to determine by themselves, are my results valid? Because if my results are not valid, I cannot interpret them. Cannot, period, end of story. They're not valid. That's what we mean by invalid. But if the results are valid, then I can interpret them. And I don't even need a lot of help to do that because people are already good at being able to do that. So the question is, how do we do it? And as, you know, we move forward and we talk about, you know, what to do, people bring up the issues, evidence-based practice. Okay, so what is evidence-based practice? Well, here's APA's definition: integration of research, the best available research with clinical expertise in the context of patient characteristics, culture, and preferences. All right, so what about the research then? Let's find out about the research, right? NASP has the same kind of thing. Here's NASP's practice model. And at the bottom, you notice the one of the foundations of service delivery is diversity and development and learning. And that really is where then that knowledge about how English learners perform on tests given to them in English, in the native language, at what age, under what kinds of programs, all of that has to be brought together there as the foundation for then basically making database decisions. So we want to bring what we have into practice. And I want to make it clear, I'm very much a pragmatist, because what troubled me a lot when I was in school psychologist before I became an academic was that I had to do something. I couldn't do nothing. I don't know if I said that right, but you understand what I'm talking about. I am in a position where I can't say, well, you know what? I don't have any tools that provide valid results, so I'm just not going to evaluate this English learner. That is not an option. So if I have to do something, what can I do? What is the best that I can do? And that's really, you know, was the impetus for a lot of the cultural language interpretive matrix. And if you look at some of the options, and Eric, you mentioned a couple of these while you were talking about the poll. They have problems. Everything has a problem. If you modify or alter your assessment, such as testing the limits or using a translator interpreter, you violate the standardization protocol of the test. You cannot then say that your results are accurate estimates of the child's abilities. Why? Because you don't know what the mean is anymore. The test you gave wasn't standardized and normed in that manner. So you don't know what the average is. You don't know what the standard deviation is. You don't know what the standard error of measure is. You don't know if what you did actually help the child or hurt the child. So it's noble and it's intended to try to work around the issue, but it's not a great workaround. You mentioned nonverbal testing. Great. What does nonverbal testing give us? Well, it tries, but it does not eliminate language completely. You can't give a nonverbal test completely in a nonverbal manner. Yeah, people say, well, I can use pantomimes. Yeah, but you have to teach a person what those gestures mean. To teach the person what those gestures mean means you just taught them a language. It's a non-oral language, but it's a language nonetheless. No test can be given by merely placing it in front of the student and walking away. You have to be able to interact with the individual. The other problem with language-reduced tests is that it kind of avoids the whole issue, doesn't it? We're dealing with English language learners, and language is at the center of the entire equation. I mean, it's at the very center of ELL, English language learners. So language is a fundamental part of what we need to understand in terms of academic development, and avoiding it isn't a complete or satisfactory solution. Plus, how are the norms any different? Does language not affect it at all? Does culture not affect it at all? We don't really know very well. We do know that it does result in higher scores, but it doesn't necessarily result in measurement of abilities that are going to be fundamentally important to any kind of evaluation. Like if you're looking at LD or you're looking at problems in reading and writing, you need to measure language because it's the ability that predicts reading and writing best. And then there were some other things you mentioned, although you were cutting out a little bit, Eric, so I didn't quite get it, but I did hear bits and pieces of this where people will say, well, I'll do dominance testing and then I'll test in the native language, or I'll do dominance testing and then I'll test in English because they're dominant in English. Well, dominance really just tells you which language may be better developed, but it doesn't tell you that the child is age appropriate in that language. When I started school, I myself am an English learner. By the time I was, let's say, 6 years old, 7 years old, I began learning a little bit of English. So I was probably still dominant in Spanish, but I hadn't been instructed in Spanish. So if you evaluated me in the native language, why would you expect my development to continue to be age appropriate when I'm not receiving instruction in that language? Likewise, by the time I'm in third grade, English is now my dominant language. If you then test my dominance and you test me in English, do you get valid results? No, because you're comparing me to 8-year-old kids who've been learning English from birth. For 8 years. I've only been doing it for 3. So these are ideas that have really, I think, become entrenched in the field, and which I have tried very hard to say they just don't work. If they were all or any one of them by themselves a solution, then we would just say, everybody do this. But it's not really going to happen. That isn't what's going to happen. There's only one thing we can actually do. And the big key is what's happening to the left of this chart. We don't have norm sample representation of bilingual development. A child who's an English learner in the United States is by definition bilingual. Now, more importantly, you have to understand the terms. Bilingual means you're exposed to two languages, okay? An English learner means you're exposed to at least two languages, the first of which is not English. So you're an English learner because you're learning English as a second language. So you're not a monolingual native English speaker. That also differs from limited English proficient. Limited English proficient is a federal term which really relates to a child who's been identified as having a limited level of English ability such that they're entitled to a special linguistic program under the mandate of Lau versus Nichols, the Supreme Court decision that basically established the whole reason why we send home the home language survey. So they're different. And once a limited English proficient student becomes a fluent English speaker by passing the WIDA, the ELPA, the LPAT, the TELPAS, the NISA slot, whichever state and whatever one you're using, that doesn't mean the child suddenly stops being an English learner. And that's what's key. You just never stop being an English learner, and to evaluate a child as if they were always a native, monolingual native English speaker is flat wrong. So where are we going to get this information? The only place we're going to get it is going to have to be the research, because the research has got to tell us what to do. So, all right. What does the research tell? I'm going to show you some contemporary results here, a little bit of historical results, but I'm going to keep it contemporary. And I'm going to use some samples that come from a couple of studies that most people who know about the freedom are probably familiar with, because they got a lot of visibility. And it's kind of like it troubled everybody. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's like the Selim doesn't work. Oh, it's like not happening. Oh, my. There's a problem. There's a problem. So I thought, what better way to examine the issue than to look exactly at those studies, particularly by Stick and Watkins, at 2013, 2014. And let's take a look. So let's start at the broad ability level, okay? Number one, does the mean full scale IQ differ by whether you're an ELL or a non-ELL? We know this has gone on for 100 years. And if you look at their results, well, you get the same thing. The far left group is the standardization sample from the WISC-IV, primarily monolingual native English speakers. What kind of mean do they get? They get 100. The next sample over, though, was a referred sample, okay, so referred, but found not to be eligible, of native English speakers as well. So what do you get there? Well, you get a average full scale IQ of 96. Yeah, it's really not enough to put the kid in special education services. So you end up with about an average of 98. Well, what about the English learner samples in those two studies? For the 2013, you can see it was about an 86, 87. And for the other ELL group, it was about, you know, an 83. So on average, about an 85. And that difference of about one standard deviation is ubiquitous. It is typical. It comes up all of the time in research. This is not the only study to do it. I just wanted to use contemporary studies to examine it. Now, we don't care about that because we think, well, but it's language. Is language really playing a role in this? Well, let's look at the index level. So let's drill more closely to what's happening here. I'm going to use the same studies. I'm going to add one of their studies right in the middle there. They had a sample of English-speaking kids who were autistic. And why they were included, I have no idea. I think the idea was, well, let's see if autistic kids show a pattern like ELL kids. Well, as you can see here, if we start with the left again, the native English speakers from the standardization show no difference in their indexes. And notice that the indexes are arranged from left to right: perceptual reasoning, processing speed, working memory, verbal comprehension index. That is intentionally and arbitrarily from low language, low culture to higher language, higher culture. No difference in terms of the English speaking standardization sample, but a little bit of a difference, not much, but a little bit of a difference, 2 to 3 points for the English speaking sample that was referred. And what do you think are the most common reasons for referral? Got to be reading, got to be writing difficulties, right? In other words, it's language related. And guess what? Their performance shows a little bit of that language kind of difference, which is probably why they were referred in the first place. But when your lowest index is a 93, you don't end up in special ed. Makes sense. Now, what about the two ELL groups? Look at the difference between their more nonverbalish kinds of scores and their more verbalish scores. Extreme differences, which again is very common, very typical with ELL samples, whether or not they happen to be non-disabled or disabled. In both of these cases, they were actually groups with disabilities, which is an important point. I'll get back to that a little bit later. But the difference is there. They perform better on nonverbal tasks. They perform worse on more verbal tasks. The autistic group in the middle I don't know what to say about that, but I'm pretty darn sure that that pattern of performance has no relationship to the ELL group. So if autistic kids have some kind of issues or whatever, they don't look like ELLs, all right? So enough of that. Now, that's where people used to kind of end it. And they used to think it was verbal versus nonverbal in terms of a simple dichotomy. It's not, okay? When you look further, let's go to the subtest level now. What do you see for the group on the left, the native English speakers? You see absolutely no difference again. And once more, look at the pattern of the scores at the bottom here as they are arranged, not an arbitrary order. Picture concepts, matrix reasoning, symbol search, block design. To the left, low language, low culture type tests. On the other side, vocabulary, digit span, similarities, information. Higher language, higher culture to the right. Everything else sort of in the middle somewhere. So do you see a difference with the native English speakers? Absolutely not. Why not? Because age is an effective control for a monolingual speaker in terms of language. If you're 10 years old and you're a monolingual native English speaker, how long have you been learning English? 10 years. It's simple. That doesn't hold for an English learner. And so that's why you begin to see differences. Now, look at the next group. That was the referred group of English speakers, native English speakers. Once again, a slight decline relative to probably language, as no doubt related to the manifest reading and writing difficulties which prompted the referral. So it's there. You even see it in their results. Not that the signum is used with native English speakers, but you still see it. But look at the drops. Look at the variability in the English learner groups to the other side. You go from being, 98 in that one group down to 85. You go from 94 in one group down to about 81 in the other group. There are significant and more severe and extreme drops as a function of the amount of language that begins to be required developmentally by a particular subtest. And again, the autistic kids in the middle there, I don't know, but that looks pretty random to me. I have no idea what that means, but I just want to show you that is not an ELL pattern. Okay, the ELL pattern is to the right. Okay. I just kept that one in because they had it as a sample, so we really didn't want to throw it out. Now, how different are those findings from some historical research? Here you have Jane Mercer's work with the SAMPA in 1972, Diana Vukovic, Richard Figueroa's follow-up to them. 10 years after, they took a subset, about 400 kids followed them, and look, their scores went up, but look at the pattern. And again, look at the order, not arbitrary. Information, vocabulary, similarities, right? Language loaded at the top. Coding, picture completion, object assembly, box design, non-language toward the bottom. And there's an increase in performance as you move away from language-based tests. Not only in those two, but Jim Cummins' work with French English immersion students in Canada. People were talking about Bix and Kalp. Here's Mr. Bix and Kalp right here. And what is he saying? He's saying, hey, that basically even kids who are learning French as their second language and English is their native language really show this kind of pattern as well. They don't develop right in the same way in all of the tests. They follow a pattern where they do more poorly on the language ones, they do better on the non-language ones. And then this is just one of my students. I have many, but I just threw one in here from Long Island with a group of Hispanic students. You can see the parallel to really Mercer's group there. So when you look at these studies, in particular, you look at them like visually. And I think this is an important analysis. This is what you see. You can go back and take not just these four, but many other studies, and you see this level of decline that is rather ubiquitous and powerful and almost it's everywhere. It just doesn't go away. There is a decline that is linear and proportion relative to what a particular test is asking. And why does that happen? Because in an English learner, language development in English, in this case, is not tied to age. It's tied to exposure. I can be a 10-year-old English learner who got here from Puerto Rico just last year. So that means I've been learning English for less than 3 to 6 months. But I can be a 10-year-old English learner who's been in the United States the whole time, started school at the age of 5, and been learning English for 5 years. So you can't compare both of us and say, oh, we're all the same. All English learners are the same. It's different. It's how much English exposure have I had, not only relative to native English speakers, but as you're going to see, relative to other English learners as well. So this is really the kind of continuum that I'm trying to get people to understand. And I just laid it out here very simply: high, moderate, low. This is what we've always gone with, and we know about what that level of decline is. And we saw some great validation of this particular notion recently in a study that I'm going to bring up in a little bit that was wonderful. But the basic idea is that if you give a test that is more nonverbal to the left in this chart, then you get a score closer to the mean. You give a test that is very verbal, vocabulary, similarities, you get a score that's further and further away from the mean. You give something that's kind of in between, you know, like digit span, you get something that's more in the middle. That's all that the research has been able to teach us. And, you know, it's hard to parse that out specifically because the research, unfortunately, tends to be rather chaotic. It's not very systematic. Sometimes it's actually quite poor. But it brings up two clear issues. That number one, when we compare children in terms of testing, we have to compare ELLs versus non-ELLs, and that gives us a degree to which we know they are moving away from the mean. Now, if we move further away from the mean on language-loaded tasks, that's okay. That's what's expected. If we move just barely away from the mean on more nonverbal tasks, that's okay too. That's exactly what's also expected. But there's another thing. I mentioned English learners compared to other English learners. If I've only been learning English for 5 years and I'm 10 years old, then I'm not going to do as well as a native English speaker who's been learning it for 10 years. But I'm going to do a lot better than another 10-year-old who's been learning English for only 1 year. And so we have to then make some allowance for the difference between English learners, because by and large, historically, they have been treated as if they were a monolithic group, and they are not. And this is what truly makes the problem, because if we were just talking about ELLs and they had no differences among them, our task would be simple. But there are vast differences among them. In fact, I'm going to show you a couple of studies here. The only ones that have actually ever looked at the effect of language proficiency itself on actual test performance. And here it is at the broad ability level. This is Dr. Satella Dinegas, a former student of mine. She's now our program director, so technically she's my boss. And she looked at the GIA-3, the WJ-3 GIA, I should say. And she looked at the NICE slot, which is like the WIDA, the LPAT, TELPAS, whatever you have. And it had four categories at the time. And those kids who were ranked as proficient, right, were at 101. But the kids who were at the advanced, which is supposed to be pretty good, were almost 11 points below the mean. Kids who were at the intermediate level were 82, right? And kids who were at the beginning level were nearly two standard deviations below the mean. So we must then understand that while there's an average difference for ELLs, which again comes out to be about 15 points on average, the reality is that there are some children for whom that difference might be as much as two standard deviations. If you're working with a child who's a beginner in terms of English learning, you cannot possibly expect them to take a vocabulary test, a similarities test, an information test, and score somewhere within the average range compared to native English speakers, or even compared to other English learners that you may be working with, because they don't have that level of development. Now, again, broad ability level, we don't worry too much about, but let's dig beyond that. Let's go to the subtests again and look at it individually. At the bottom here are the same data, but notice that we have the names of the tests: SR, spatial relations, VM, visual matching. So the less language, less culture loaded. On the far right, you have verbal comprehension, BC, concept formation, which doesn't seem like it's a very language loaded test, except that the instructions themselves are quite involved. And those of you familiar with concept formation on WJ3 and 4, you know what I'm talking about there. Now, once again, if you plot the performance on these subtests, okay, from left to right, what do you get? Well, the highly proficient group, they move along pretty much above the mean. They only drop a little bit toward the very end. So very close to being able to use monolingual English speaking norms without really much of a problem. But the moment you go to the advanced level, it doesn't quite show that same trend line. You go to the intermediate level, it really drops significantly. And you go to the beginning level, it drops even further. This highlights that there is, again, a proportional and linear effect of language on test results. And by the way, this also tends to show that it's not that beginners have lower intelligence or intellectual ability, and that's why they're scoring low. Because if that were the case, we'd have parallel lines here. That blue line would be a parallel line down there around 70, showing that all of the abilities were low. And that's not what we have. If you give tests that really don't require much language, even a child at the beginning level of English learning can perform nearly as well or as well as kids with much greater proficiency in English, precisely because you're not tapping into that particular ability. Now, I wish this were the only, or I'm sorry, I wish it weren't the only test that, we could talk about this way. But it begins to highlight that kind of gradual linear attenuation of performance. And here it is again. This is a study by Dr. Dinda. She showed here that the Woodcock-Munoz Language Survey plus the Wechsler Abbreviated Scales of Intelligence, when laid out again with low language, low culture tests to the left, high language, high culture tests to the right, produced a particular kind of pattern that was very similar to what I just showed you. The kids who were at the high proficiency level, they only dropped toward the very end and they stay within the average range. Almost, so they're in pretty good shape. But the intermediate proficient drop more. Those who are low proficient drop even further. So once again, we see this kind of increasing degree of attenuation in terms of test performance as we move along that spectrum. And this is hugely important because if I'm going to work with ELLs, I can't treat them all the same. If I have an ELL who is high proficient and I use that as the standard for a child who is low proficient, then I'm going to be biased against the low proficient child, even if I'm trying to do everything else in my power to be unbiased. So it's not just comparing to native English speakers and figuring out what that's going to do. It's also comparing to other English learners and figuring out what that's going to do as well. So that's it. That's what the research kind of tells us in terms of the performance of English language learners, that English language test performance is moderated by the degree to which any given index or subtest or even full-scale IQ requires or relies on age-expected development in English, all right, as well as the acquisition of acculturative knowledge, although we don't examine that one too hard because it's very difficult to operationalize, but it's highly correlated with language. So if you're talking about language, you usually talk about acculturative knowledge as well. And then number two, because ELLs vary as a group, they are not the same. We can't treat all ELLs the same or say there's a single standard for ELLs that they all should perform like because they vary in terms of their own development in the language in which we're testing them, whether that's English or even the native language. So what do we get? Well, what we have to do then is to create, as we saw earlier, some kind of true peer comparison group. How do we bring this together in a way that allows us to put it in some manner that you can use it as a practitioner? Because this is what you'd have to do. In other words, if you wanted to engage in evidence-based practice as an evaluator, you'd have to do everything that I've shown you. You'd have to research everything that I've shown you. You'd have to come up with your own system for being able to put that all together, figure out what the process should be, figure out what the conversion should be like, figure out what the decline should be for all of the tests that you might be giving, and then develop some kind of framework for being able to interpret the results relative to the proficiency of the child that you have. You'd have to do all of that. How many of you are going to do it? I'll wait. I hear the crickets going. Nobody's going to do it, okay? And I don't blame you because it's too, you know what, hard to do, all right? Nobody has that time. But why should you have to do it if somebody's already done it for you? That's what I've done. I've spent the last 25 years trying to make your life easy. And this is what I'm talking about here. It's really simple. It's not simple, but it is simple. If you have a native English speaker and you have a graph like this, you have the shaded range for average, okay? And a child scores like this, a native English speaking child, right? Right down the middle on everything you gave them, okay? Your interpretation of this is, oh, they're average, right? We have no question about that. Nothing worries you. Nothing troubles you about that. What if I take those subtests at the bottom and I reorder them? I put them randomly. I put them systematically. I change them up. I don't know. Does it change your interpretation? No. If the scores are what they are, it doesn't matter how the tests are arranged. In other words, language will never affect this because the age or the language of the child is basically controlled. So as long as they're in the average range on everything, they are in the average range. You only get a little worried when you see some variability. But a little variability doesn't bother you, does it? Does this change your interpretation of these results? Are you looking at this thinking, oh, now something's going on? No. All right. What about this? Yeah. Now you see, oh my goodness, there's a couple of low scores there. Now you begin to say, okay, my interpretation of this is not that the child is average per se, but that there's maybe some difficulties in certain areas like arithmetic, letter number sequencing. So we would investigate that. In other words, this begins to tell you that this child may in fact have some deficit. Well, We can do the same thing with English language learners. How? Here's exactly how it's done. You remember that chart I showed you before? If I just go back, I convert those scores, I create a grand mean, I say, here's what the numbers come out like. All right, if you take, you can do this all yourself. You can double check my math if you'd like. All right, it's right there. Test with high language, moderate language, low language. Here they are from 85, one standard deviation below the mean, all the way up to 99, pretty much at 100. And then you make decisions. Are they arbitrary decisions? Yeah, for the most part, but they're linear and they're okay. So you could say, you know, 85, 87, all right, level 5, 89, 89, level 4, 90, 92, 96, level 3, 97, 80, level 2, 97, 99, level 1. This is what you do. And if you did that, here's what happens. If I take this kid again that we were talking about before, and I arrange those tests at the bottom to low language, moderate language, high language in terms of what I just showed you, okay? Their performance is not like this because for them, these are not the averages. They're not scoring 100 on everything. In fact, what you see is a 99 in matrix reasoning, then a 96 in picture concepts, a 94. You see how it begins to decline little by little by little. And as we move across, we start getting into not just the moderate, but to the high language demands. Now you see scores that are falling outside the average range because remember, for vocabulary, it's down there around 85. So that means that for an English learner, the average range isn't this parallel line with the parallel shading. The average level of performance is a diagonal line with a diagonal range of shading. That's what it means. If a child is scoring within that range in vocabulary, regardless of the magnitude of the score or the percentile rank, that suggests that their development in English is average. That's what it must be. If we're going to interpret relative to what the research is telling us, this is how we interpret it. And it's really pretty simple. It's not any different than what you're doing. And when those scores are a little bit variable, that doesn't bother us. When those scores are above the line, that doesn't bother us. When those scores become lower than the shaded range, that's what begins to bother us. And that's precisely what the Selim is all about. If you were to look at the matrix, and you know, the matrix is an arbitrary design. We could have done it linearly and more hierarchically. I'm leaning more toward that more recently. That's why I have it here as level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, and level 5. But the point being that you can take those subtests, which I showed you previously, put the score that they are associated with, and just arrange them in a way that the highest score is in the upper left, the lowest score is in the lower right, and the other scores are somewhere in between. That's what the matrix does for you. It was just a simple way of trying to give you a visual representation of the pattern of scores that your examinee, the child you worked with, obtained to be able to determine, did they decline systematically in concert with what would be expected to be the average range, give or take a little bit of measurement error along the way. And this then was another adjustment necessary on the basis of those two other studies that I told you about, which were relative to how much of a drop would we expect based on proficiency. So this is tough because there is very, very, other than the two studies I've shown you, very, very little research on this. People don't understand this and they don't research it this way. They don't control for language proficiency. And because they don't, they very often don't even understand the characteristics of the samples that they're working with. Everybody thinks they can create an EL sample, but they really can't. They really don't understand what those variables need to be like, and so they make a bunch of mistakes. What kind of mistakes? Well, I'm going to show you, okay? Because here's a picture of the matrix itself, all right, the graph that comes along with it. And on the left side here, you can see a declining overall pattern. As I showed you before, this child's performance is not only declining as a function of language increasing, it's also within the expected range as established by research. That's what that line represents, the values according to research. So this is very consistent with that, which means what? And this is where things get a little counterintuitive. The results are likely to be invalid because what you measured, all right, were oranges, not bananas. Or to put that in psychological terms, what you measured was the effect of language rather than the ability that you were actually trying to measure. That's why it's invalid. But it also denotes average performance because this child's performance is commensurate with other individuals who are not disabled, of average ability, and they performed in this way. So this child, by inference, must also be average ability and probably not disabled. Now, the one on the right is different. the scores don't have this systematic overall decline. Things are weirder there. In other words, culture and language cannot explain the entirety of those results. Something else is going on there, particularly with the two in the middle. Why are those much lower than other ones when maybe they should be a little bit higher? If the effect of culture and language what was affecting the performance, then those tests should be a little bit, you know, higher, but they're lower than that, which means other things are going on here. This means that your results are likely to be valid. Why valid? Well, because when you examine the influence of culture and language, you don't see it. It's not there. It's not powerful enough to invalidate your results. So you may now go forth and interpret your results, all right, for the most part, without having to use, and this is one of my favorite terms, without having to use extreme caution, okay? Because that doesn't mean anything. When you write that, please don't write that. It just means you're about to interpret results you shouldn't be interpreting and you want to be forgiven for the sins that you're about to commit. Don't do that, all right? If your results are valid, interpret them. If your results are not valid, don't interpret them. So let's look at some of the research then directly, because I think this is something that has come up that confuses people, and rightly so. I mean, I try to make it simple here, but it's not nearly as simple as it might seem. And this is a good example. This is one of the early studies that John Kranzler did along with a couple of his graduate students. And so they had a sample of English learners comprised primarily mean age of 11. So they're sixth graders. Of those ELLs, 74% had been educated in their native language and country prior to coming to the U.S. Eric, you mentioned like the concepts of Bix and CALP earlier. What does this imply? This implies that these individuals had CALP in their native language prior to coming to the U.S., okay? So that's something that we'd have to consider in terms of expected performance. And what would that be? Well, if I've developed CALP, from what we know particularly about the Thomas and Collier studies, we know that your learning of English will take place fairly quickly, 1 to 3 years, and that you'll be in grade level at that point because you're simply transferring the skills that have already been developed and uninterrupted into English. Okay, so you shouldn't have much trouble. Well, they had an N of basically 46, okay? No control regarding level of English language proficiency or native language proficiency, although obviously based on this, we know that a native language is probably pretty high. So what did they get? Well, here's the data from the WJ3 put into the matrix in terms of what they got. All right. And I like looking at this, but it's very difficult to interpret this. So I'd rather move to like the graph because it's a lot easier to look at. So what do we have here? You notice that in this case, I've marked this as slightly different rather than moderately or markedly different. Why slightly different? When 75% or 3/4 of your sample has already been educated in English, that makes them far more educated and, let's say, the beneficiaries of the type of education that does not interrupt language. So that means they shouldn't be having much trouble with English. And this shows they're not having much trouble with English. And I think it's remarkable because when you look at this, you would say, by and large, their sample is pretty much showing an average pattern of performance. And they were. These are non-disabled kids, probably doing quite well. Their performance is a little bit higher than the average ELL, and it's precisely what we would expect. So what was kind of the issue here? Well, I mean, they said that the classifications needed to be changed. But when I look at the classifications, on the left were the original classifications. On the right was the order of the means they got. As you can see, the only ones that really are a little bit different is at level 4, where I have GLR a little bit higher and GA a little bit lower. But those are in the same level. So I could interchange them to make it look perfectly like that, and it would look exactly like that. So the classifications were actually quite consistent with what they found, all right? It's just that there wasn't that much of a difference between performance from cell to cell. And that really was, I think, the biggest problem. It wasn't really the classification, because when you have 7 out of the 10 classifications really kind of following what you're looking at, there really is no problem here. This is what the problem was. Look at the differences in samples between another study. This was the Sotelo-Genega study earlier on. The big differences come over here, in particular, between those two, which are basically auditory processing or sound blending and visual auditory learning. Well, why would auditory processing be high for a non-native English speaker coming from another country when they've not been exposed to those phonemes? There is no such thing as linguistic transfer of phonemes. That doesn't work that way. So the kids who are in third grade are learning phonemes far better in English than the kids who are coming later. That's why those kids coming a little bit later are likely to develop what we call an accent. So it makes sense. The GLR, long-term visual auditory learning has to do with learning to read and developing fluency in that language. Well, their fluency was developed in their native language, not in English. So they're not going to perform as well. Where do they perform as well? Right there, GF, which is the indication of the CALP level of ability that these individuals have. Third graders don't have CALP, but sixth graders do on average. And these kids with solid native language education are displaying it. So their sample is really okay. But when you're trying to find differences between them, I just did this for the sake of illustration here, because they were looking for differences between the values in adjacent cells. Well, this power analysis kind of clearly shows that to be able to find a difference of, let's say, 3 to 4 points, all right, means that you have to have samples that can run as high as 300 per. And we had 46. At 46, the power for this in terms of finding a difference was 0.25, not 0.8. And yet, a statistically significant decreasing trend was found for the effect of linguistic demand and cultural loading combined. So I don't know why all the criticism. I don't know why everybody's dying. I'm perfectly happy with this. This says, yes, they found it, especially because they couldn't find a small difference because they didn't have a big enough sample. But when you go to a more moderate difference between non-adjacent cells, they did find that difference, which means that difference must be substantial if you can identify it at a moderate level with only 46 kinds of in your sample. So I don't know. But anyway, so people got all bent out of shape out of that one. And then came the Tustick and Watkins studies. Well, here's where things get a little more complicated. I already showed you what their data were like. So they really look a lot like what I've explained. So why would they come to a completely different conclusion than what I might have come to? Well, here's part of the problem, okay? Notice that they wrote here, the valid Celent profile, all right, i.e. the cell means, did not decline, all right? That kind of pattern emerged in the mean WISC-IV normative sample and the ELL sample. Huh, okay, so they didn't decline in the ELL sample. Well, yeah, they did. If you look back on what I showed you, there was a clear decline, but why would they expect there to be a clear decline anyway? Because their ELL sample was based on children with disabilities, not children without disabilities. And if the ELL pattern, the valid pattern, exists with no decline, then their ELL sample should have had no decline, and their WISC normative sample should have also had no decline. And that is precisely what they found. So I'm thinking, all right, this looks really good, and I'm very happy for it. And if you want to see how much of a decline there actually was, when you look at their data, and so it's kind of like I'm sort of damned if I do, damned if I don't, because the scores kind of decline. Look at the 2013 mean. Look at the difference between it. Look at the 2014 means. Look at the difference between those scores and the mean from the normative sample. So the first one goes from 4 all the way to 17. The other one goes from 8 to 20. I think there's pretty much a decline going on there. But that wasn't really the biggest problem. We can talk about that. Yes, it declined. It was LD. 76% of the kids had LD. Well, I'm sorry, 97% had some type of educational disability. 76% of them had LD, and the rest of them had speech language impairment. This was the bigger problem, all right? Because when I look at those patterns, and here they are in the middle from 2013 to 2014, they don't look a whole lot different than anything that I've shown you before. So again, I'm kind of stumped as to why then could they have come up with these kinds of conclusions? Because here's they continued right here. Neither sample of children exhibited the invalid Celent profile when group mean scores were considered. And then, all right, they looked at it individually, but I just showed you the group mean scores. So I don't know. I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, seems like it was declining. Well, should probably decline. It did decline. Okay. Well, I don't know. Maybe they didn't feel that it did, but remember that they're working with a sample of English learners who have disabilities. They've already been identified, not identified with the CNM, but previously identified by a school district. And then they basically, you know, if they had taken the data and put it into the chart, what you see is on the left what their data look like. So maybe they were thinking that big bump in the middle is a problem. Okay, and the 2014 has a little bit of a bump in the middle as well. Where does that bump come from? Well, when you look at it, it actually comes from, all right, three tests that didn't really follow the pattern. And the biggest one making that bump is probably digit span, or might be a little bit of comprehension, but it's probably digit span. Picture concepts, I would agree 100% with them. And this is the kind of research that I would like to see is, if you do this, tell me what you think needs to be changed. All right. I don't see any change for matrix reasoning, symbol search, block design, coding, letter number sequencing, similarities, or vocabulary. If you want to argue and say picture concepts you have wrong, I would agree. I would say, you know what, that one we messed up. I don't know how it ended up there. We probably classified it prior to having any research, but with your research, all right, I'm willing to put it up there because it's consistent with other research that has come out. Comprehension, I don't see quite that high, but I'm willing to go level 3 or 4 on that one because I have seen some other studies that put it about level 4, so maybe we're okay. But digit span, never seen digit span that low unless it's digit span forward only. If it's digit span forward only, yeah, that could be it. But to me, when it's inconsistent with other research, ELLs typically perform at about tier 3 with digit span, not tier 5. So I can't really say that, all right, you know, this is definitive, but I'm willing to discuss it. Nevertheless, look at how many of those are actually consistent with what we had. What do you say that if you get 7 out of 10 subtests falling exactly in line with what the research has already told you, that that kind of strengthens the idea of what you're doing with the CLIM? Yeah, it really should. So why didn't it? Well, look at this. All I did was I changed, okay, those 3 classifications to be more consistent both with the research that we have and what they found. So put that picture concepts up there, move comprehension over a little bit, and guess what you get? Nice, beautiful pattern. And this is what I really wish people would do. Find out what you think those patterns should be, and then let's talk about it. Let's figure it out. The CLIM isn't meant to be a static tool. It's dynamic. It's based on research as it comes out, and as more research comes out, we modify it because it can't be definitive in any kind of sense. You have to continue. But the biggest problem was this, all right? Many of you probably remember this. They made this statement, roughly 97%, 83 of the participants, okay, out of the 86, were identified as meeting criteria for educational disability. So they looked at individual profiles. Now, remember, if these kids, 97% of them have a disability, should they show a valid profile or an invalid profile? Well, if they have a disability, truly, and the district was correct in their decision-making, they should have a valid profile. That is, the results should not decline because that would then establish the presence of a disability, as was done. If they have a declining pattern, you know, on an individual basis, that would be bad because that's saying that's a normal kind of pattern of decline, so they should not have a disability. Well, let's see what they got. This is a chart directly from their study. Notice they say invalid scores decline. Okay, invalid scores are supposed to decline. And in their ELL group, only 9 of their subjects had that decline. Well, since 97% of that group had a disability, there shouldn't be very many. And in fact, there weren't. If you take out the 3 who were probably correctly identified as having a declining pattern being normal, that means 6 kids were in that group who maybe shouldn't have been in that group, but 89.5 were exactly in the group that the CLIM would have guided you to say these scores are valid and you may interpret them. In fact, if you have evidence to indicate there was a disability, the CLIM would have supported you in that 89.5% of those cases, plus the 3.5 where you would have said does not qualify, which means the CLIM would have been correct in 93% of the decisions made in that sample. That's pretty amazing. And look, if you do it with native English speakers, should they have like an invalid score, a decline? No. And only 4.9% did. And I bet some of those kids are kids that might have very mild language-based disabilities. But 95% of children who are just normal modeling language speakers don't show that decline because they're not supposed to show that decline. I don't think I could have come up with more powerful evidence in support of the CLIM than what you see in front of you here. But what was the conclusion? Oh my God, the sky is falling. It doesn't work. You should worry. Oh, you know, throw it away because like I must be crazy. I mean, I really, it's hard sometimes not to take some of these things personally, but if it really didn't do this, if it didn't really provide what it's supposed to provide, I couldn't recommend it to you. I can't spend 25 years researching this and tell you to do something that I think is a bunch of BS. This is great research. It's just that when people read these studies, they have no idea what they mean. They read the abstract, they read the conclusions, and they think, oh, there's a big problem. Now, here's some additional evidence. I'll go through this very quickly here because I think this is a very powerful one. More recently, Kip McGrew and one of his former students, Damien Cormier and Jim Iseldyk, they took the WJ3 normative update sample, and they evaluated it in a very unusual way. Now, they were thinking they had an ELL sample. But when I actually look at their results, they're not clear in terms of what they're doing. And it really does appear that they're using the entire normative update sample, which means that at best, if you go by foreign-born status, only 5% of those individuals are foreign-born. If you go by English spoken at home, only 11% actually have English spoken at home. Or if you go by English as a first language, only 8.5% have English as a first language. So by and large, the norms are driven predominantly by the native English speaking group. All right. So is this an ELL sample? No. Does it make any difference? No, not at all. Because what did they do? This is what they did. They took the WJA oral language tests, a couple of them, and a couple from the Academic Achievement Battery, and they operationalized language independent of these tests from the Cognitive Battery. So what they did was they said, okay, let's measure your language ability, and then let's see how much variance is explained on each of these particular tests. Look at the list. And again, look at the top, look at the bottom, all right? Verbal comprehension. How much does language have to do with your performance on verbal comprehension? 79% of the variance for 7 to 10 year olds, 86% of the variance for 11 to 14, 81% for 15 to 18. In other words, if your language is high, you do well on verbal comprehension. Your language is low, you do poorly on verbal comprehension. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It makes sense. Nearly all of the variance is accounted for by language. But then, as you go down, it's a little less. Although, notice that general information, which is a measure of acculturative knowledge, still remains quite high. That's why I told you that acculturative knowledge and language are really correlated. So it's hard to tease them apart because you can't independently operationalize acculturative knowledge. The only way to do that is to give a test of acculturative knowledge. So you'd have to give a different test of acculturative knowledge, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So anyway, it's still correlated. Then you keep going on concept formation, which is the test that has a lot of language loading, visual auditory learning, etc. Go all the way down to the bottom, picture recall, planning, spatial relations. Look how much variance is being accounted for there. 0.02, 2%, 7%, 8%, barely any. In other words, why you perform on those tests has very little, if anything, to do with language. This is a great, great examination showing how a particular subtest retains an amount of demand related to language and acculturative knowledge, independent of the person who's taking it. And so if the person taking it is not one by whom, let's say, language has been controlled. So 10-year-olds have been learning English for 10-year-olds, but an ELL who's been learning English for only 5 years doesn't have that. Then the performance is even more profoundly affected. And they recognize this. Not only did they see this kind of decline, but you can see that you really have this very easy way of saying highest language demands, lowest language demands. And I put these orange lines in there for you to be able to see. You got level one, two, three, four, and five. It's very easy for me then to take these classifications, put them in the matrix for you, and say, here is what you should expect to find if you give these particular tests. And I think their conclusions were really very good because they thought, well, this only has something to do with kids who are culturally and linguistically different. No, it doesn't. They recognize that, wait a minute, we are finding this as an issue even for native English speaking children. If they have speech and language difficulties, their scores, you can see it right there, may also be attenuated due to this testing variable. I think this is, again, very, very important and trying to understand. And again, their performance, the amount of variance accounted for here, remember, was in a very restricted sample, not a full spectrum sample, because they didn't have any limited English proficient kids in there. They were all highly proficient English learners, regardless of first language or second language. And likewise, I think here, the conclusion, right? It says linguistic demand is an important consideration when selecting and interpreting tests of cognitive abilities. The implications of the study go beyond a reclassification of CLIM to emphasizing one of the underlying motivations of the CLIM's initial inception, the importance of considering a student's linguistic background and abilities prior to selecting, administering, and interpreting tests of cognitive abilities. Eric, when you said that people evaluate and take into consideration things like family history, educational history, Bix and Kalb level, and so on, this is what is meant by that. You know, when you take those factors into account, that's wonderful. But how do you then evaluate them? How do you do it systematically so that you're not doing it randomly or haphazardly in every single case? If you do things in an idiosyncratic manner, it's not evidence-based. It's not replicable. It doesn't work. So the CLIM makes it more systematic for you. And again, I think that this study, may be difficult for people to understand, provides tremendous empirical support for how things work. And it emphasizes with the bottom line down here that, basically, that school psychologists should consider the influence of linguistic ability when assessing cognitive abilities and should continue to be supported by empirical evidence instead of school psychologists continue to rely on informal measures of linguistic ability through samples and student interviews. In other words, they're saying if we have research and we can tell how much of attenuation should occur, then that's what we ought to be doing because that's what we can do. So I'm going to pause here because the rest of this actually talks a little bit about like a proof of concept. And you mentioned, Eric, the Ortiz PVAT, and Rachel, I think, mentioned it as well. And the only thing I want to say about that is that it is a test in which we took these ideas to heart and created a norm sample, which you see on the right-hand side here, a norm sample for English learners that takes into account the proportion of lifetime exposure to English. And by doing that, you solve that problem, because what you see on the left here is what I've been showing you over and over and over again. If I compare English learners to native English speakers, I get discriminatory results. But if I compare English learners to English learners, I get average scores. And that's what we need to have. This is really, I think, something that will change where we're going, because we haven't done anything in the past century. We need to provide true peer comparison groups. And the only way we're going to do that is to have English learner groups controlled by amount of exposure and comparing them to themselves. Without that, there's no way to demonstrate the validity of the results unless, again, you're using the CLIM, because that's the purpose of the CLIM, since without this kind of a test, there's nothing else that you can do. And I often ask people, if you're not using the CLIM, then how do you know your results are valid? You tell me. I want to know. All right? And if you got a better idea for demonstrating the validity of your results, I'm right here, and I want to hear about it. So I'm going to pause here. That's my hour. Like I said, there's a couple more slides here, but we don't need to go through them because I bet there's a bunch of questions over here and everybody's probably been waving at me and I haven't been looking at them. But I'm willing to stay on and I'm willing to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Awesome. We so appreciate like your willingness to come on and to stay on. And I know that you said, you know, you're willing to stay a little bit longer and maybe chat with us because there have been a couple of questions. And I've just been like, you know, try to absorb it all because you're going so fast. And I'm like, oh, that's so interesting.
It's 25 years of research, right? Boiled down to 1 hour, 60 minutes. There you go. Okay.
Not bad. That was good.
So yeah, I was so glad that you were talking and addressing some of that research, just because from my experience, and we'll get to some viewer questions first, but I wanted to chime in. So I started using the CLIM in North Carolina after a colleague kind of showed me, and I tried it out and thought it was really good and felt like, you know, I'm doing something that can help me make these decisions. And then I read that study that you referenced from Stick and Watkins, and like the, you know, that's on the School Psych Review. So those of you that are NASP members can access that. But the basic, like the final sentence of the abstract there just says, like, you know, the CLIM is not supported by research and identifies ELL students at chance levels compared to, you know, English speakers. And so I was really glad that you addressed some of those things that you think are problematic in those papers.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing that, because that gives me some more perspective. I know things are not always black and white in psychology and science. And I did have a question. So a lot of this hinges, again, and we've talked a lot of psych podcasts about, we've got kind of two different views about subtest interpretation. So a lot of this hinges on, you know, the subtest that you're using and the test that you're using has to be a valid and accurate and reliable test. So some people say that, you know, our cognitive measures aren't all that to be able to, you know, make decisions at the subtest level. So I'm assuming that you feel, you know, that you're in the camp that subtest interpretation and all that, that you're satisfied with, you know, the utility of our cognitive evaluations, correct?
I am satisfied with the utility of a cognitive evaluation. I am not satisfied with single subtest interpretation, okay? The CLIM doesn't tell you whether there's a disability. It just tells you whether the subtests were affected by culture and language. Once you've determined that the scores are valid, you then have to go back to your protocol and then look at your indexes, look at your clusters and your composites and determine, do I have good composites that tell me that an ability area is low? So for interpretive purposes, for making a diagnostic decision regarding a disability, I would never hinge that upon a single subtest. That's poor practice. You need to look at the more reliable indexes. You know, we're dealing with latent variables here, not manifest variables, so they must be, let's say, aggregated to produce the kind of reliability necessary for that kind of decision making.
Okay, very cool. And then the other comment that I just wanted to make was just that it was like an aha moment for me. I get an evaluation, and just what we were saying about the exposure being so important. And I know that, you know, I consider that, and I think about that, and, you know, oh, they've been in the country for this long, or they've been at school for this long. But I think that just some of what you were talking about there made it really drove it home that we need to start really looking at that more.
Yeah. You know, I've been studying these areas for so long that I can, you know, off the top of my head, form an expectation as to where a child should be cognitively and academically based on the type of program that they have, you know, the current age and grade that they're in, how long they've been in school, their current level of proficiency, and so on. So I can do that. But how does the average practitioner do that? I mean, how many people who are listening right now actually have a course in evaluating ELLs? And if they have a course, is it a course entirely on evaluating ELLs? Or is it like, you know, a chapter in a book that they read as, you know, for 1 week during the semester? So it's hard for people to get that kind of knowledge. And that's the whole point of using the research here within the structure of the CLIM. The research does that for you without you having to worry about it. And it permits you to make good decisions without having to have all that technical knowledge right at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I that exposure point really resonated with me also, because it's so complicated. Even if you know how long a child has been here, you don't know how rich the language environment is, whether it be in class or at home. And so if there were more ways to really understand how much exposure to the language children have had and how rich it is, I think that would make for a much, more informed approach.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's an important issue, by the way, going back to Rachel's previous point on the value of cognitive testing. Even those who are in the RTI can't make this mistake as well, because RTI is based on a comparison. It's a different paradigm for measurement, but it's a measurement paradigm. And to have meaning in terms of the measurement requires a standard for comparison. Mm-hmm. So where do you get your AIM line from? Where does it come? Is it English learners in general? Is it English learners with the same level of proficiency? Is it English learners in the same types of educational programs? Probably not. And if these things are not addressed, then even if you're using RTI, you're not necessarily still using a standard that would be considered fair or unbiased to determine the rate of progress or the achievement level of a particular child. And you will misdiagnose every bit as much as if you were using cognitive tests.
So interesting. Okay, we're looking for some. We're scrolling back now because we had several questions kind of pop up, and so now we're trying to.
There shouldn't be any questions. I thought I covered it completely. What's going on here?
There were some good, very good viewer interactive questions, and I think some of them early on you may have covered as you went, but I think a lot of people seem to be looking for answers to the. Kind of what did somebody write? How should we check the box? How do we figure out whether it really is cultural influence? When do we determine whether we should do an ELL speech language assessment on an English language learner? A lot of probably detailed questions that might also require some conversation with administrators and with practicing personnel within the district too.
Yeah. And you know, the key in using the CLIM is related to the principle of exposure that Rebecca and Rachel have mentioned. You know, you have to know how different is this child relative both to other English learners as well as relative to native English speakers. And I've laid out very briefly at the bottom here some of those issues to be able to do it. And if you go into the CLIM, which, by the way, there's a link at the very beginning and a link at the end of my presentation, where you can download the CLIM, a basic version of it. It doesn't have all the great bells and whistles that are in XPass, but it is usable and it is absolutely 100% free. And in there, there's more detail regarding how can we make a decision to determine how different the child should be so that we know what would be the appropriate standard to hold that child to. And so some of that is shown here, but it's more limited. But if you go into the program itself, it's all laid out for you to be able to help you make those kinds of decisions.
That's great. And something for for maybe our audience to remember as well is NASP has some good resources. We also have a bilingual community on NASP that any member of NASP is welcome to join, bilingual school psychologist community, where a lot of these things get discussed, as well as a bilingual Facebook forum for bilingual school psychologists or school psychologists who are just interested in bicultural and bilingual informed assessments.
Right. There's a very active NASP bilingual special interest group.
Yes.
So if you subscribe to that or come to some of the meetings at NASP, very active. That group, by the way, and I'm a part of it, published in 2015 the very first position paper that had the term bilingual in it. And it was called The Provision of School Psychological Services to Bilingual Students. And the key being bilingual modifying students, not modifying school psychological services, because not everybody's bilingual. And that's some of the limitations of native language testing. If I came up with a method for evaluation that only related to, and I know Monica or Oganis talked about this previously, but if it only related to those of you who were bilingual, then only a fraction of you would be able to comply with it. So there needs to be, and what I preach, what I try to give people, is a way of being able to evaluate children regardless of your own bilingual competencies. And then there comes a point where you may need some help, but it shouldn't prevent you from engaging in and beginning that evaluation to a certain extent. And the Salem is very consistent with that as well, because it's testing in English, which everybody can do. Come to the bilingual SIG. It's a nice group, great people.
Yes. I joined this past year at NASP as well. It was fantastic.
Awesome.
Two things I wanted to mention. It's Monica's birthday. And since you put her up, happy birthday, Monica.
Happy birthday, Dr. Organis.
Happy birthday, Monica. Good, good.
And maybe just, we had just some last minute viewer questions. Carrie asked, do you feel that the use of the CLIM is adequate as opposed to a bilingual evaluation?
Well, okay. You know, I should ask Carrie. I'm too bad, Carrie. I don't have a direct line with you, because I'd put you on the spot and I'd say, what is a bilingual evaluation? How do you do it? Can you outline the steps for me and tell me exactly what they are? And then if you did that, I'd actually go through and tell you, yeah, that's not going to work. And I'd explain why. You know, I showed the one chart before in terms of native language evaluation. Let me see if I can go back. It was at the beginning. But, you know, The problem is that native language tests don't control for exposure, even in the native language. All right. So even though you're trying to do what you think is best, native language evaluation doesn't necessarily solve that problem. The Bateria 3, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on tests, so please don't get me wrong here, but the reality is that the norms are not based on the kinds of bilinguals that we work with here in the U.S. They're based on monolingual Spanish speakers from other countries. So if you want to go evaluate a kid in Colombia, then by all means, go do that. But if you're doing an evaluation in the U.S., you have to account for both languages. So the term I prefer, which I didn't display here, is multilingual assessment. All right. Meaning you're going to have to combine both languages. I just prefer to start it in English and then bring in the native language component if and when necessary. Why is it if and when necessary? Well, I mean, consider this. If you test a kid in English who's an English learner and they score average on everything you give them compared to native English speakers, are you going to bother with native language evaluation? No. You've got average scores. There's no reason to do so. But you're likely to get some low scores. Well, how do you know those low scores are valid? I just showed you how to do that with the CLIM. Okay, so now I got low scores that I think are valid according to the CLIM. What do I do next? Native language evaluation. That's where, you know, the concept or the idea of bilingual comes in. And if you are bilingual yourself, that's not a problem. You move into it seamlessly. You've got tools you might be able to use. You're trying to confirm those areas as true areas of weakness. But what if you're not bilingual? And you do realize the vast majority of English learners are not evaluated by professionals or evaluators who are bilingual themselves. The vast majority are not. And that means then that you have to call in somebody to help you, a translator, an interpreter. You know, you need help to be able to conduct what you can under the circumstances and given the limited types of resources or competencies that you might have. And I didn't show my framework for evaluation, but that's where it comes in. For multilingual assessment, it means there's no way we can identify a child as having a disability unless we have data and information in both languages. But we can determine that a child does not have a disability by testing in only one language. And we can do that easiest in English because we're not all bilingual. So for me, it's a practical issue, a feasibility issue, because I just got invited to go to North Dakota. I hope you're on the line, North Dakota. Probably not. But anyway, I just immortalized you on YouTube now. But North Dakota is calling me to come and talk about, you know, probably ELL issues. And I was in Wyoming recently, High Laramie County. And you would think that this is an issue that only affects a certain part of the country, but it doesn't. And while I was in Laramie County, there weren't people there who have bilingual capabilities. What are they going to do? Just ignore the ELLs, not evaluate them, flip a coin? I'd really prefer they didn't do that. So multilingual assessment, I think, is the term that needs to replace bilingual assessment, because we have no definition of what bilingual assessment means. We have no standards for bilingual assessment. We have no framework for bilingual assessment. Multilingual is the way to go. And I think that's the way I'm pushing it. I don't know. It maybe sounds like semantics, but I really think it's an important distinction.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
That's interesting to hear, because like in my district, we have a bilingual team, and I mean, I can't honestly say that I know what goes into their evaluations and whatnot. It's like they do some sort of magic and then they tell me what to do. So that's interesting to hear that there isn't
secret.
Really like that.
Yes. Yeah. I thought there was – seriously, the reason I ended up in academia was after 3 years of trying to figure out how to do it, I got disgusted that nobody could tell me how to do it. There was no way to say step 1, 2, 3, 4, boom, you're done. Everybody agrees this is the right way. Nothing. So it was my own bilingual background. It was my experience as a school psych and my dissatisfaction with evaluation methods that said, you know what? I'm going to go figure it out. And I spent, like I said, the last 25 years trying to do it. The CLEM, by the way, it was the only workaround at the time. If I have my way and tests begin to evolve to the use of norm samples with ELLs controlled by amount of exposure, then I would be so happy to say, you guys don't need the CLEM anymore, because now you can measure all the abilities you want, right? But that's going to be years down the road. And until that happens, or I don't know if even it's going to happen, but until that happens, the CLEM is about your best bet. And that's why it exists.
Okay. I'm looking for questions because I know we had a couple, let's see.
Yeah. Adina asked, do you know of any studies on the rate of language acquisition, or is that very complicated to study because of all the variables?
No, that's great. Oh, that's a wonderful question. I love that. Okay. First thing to know is that the sequence of language acquisition, okay, is invariant. Nobody learns English in a random manner. Nobody learns it backwards, okay? Everybody learns English in exactly the same manner, whether you're an infant, newborn, or whether you're 10 years old, 5 years old, with the education, without education. So the sequence remains the same. That's invariant. But the rate can change. And I mentioned that, you know, when I was talking about like the Kranzler study, you had 75% of those kids coming in with CALP already in their native language. So if you've been educated well enough to have developed reading, writing, and language skills, CALP ability basically in your native language, then the rate of your acquisition of English or any other second language, doesn't have to be English, but any other second language is facilitated. This is Cummins' work in terms of what he calls the developmental interdependence hypothesis. Some people just call it the iceberg model. Some people just say it's linguistic transfer due to common underlying proficiency. So you just transfer what you know. If you don't have something to transfer, then your rate of acquisition isn't as fast because there's nothing to transfer. When I was 10 years old, I didn't have CALP in my native language, so I had nothing to transfer. I was trying to learn it from scratch in English, but I was also trying to learn to comprehend English in the first place. So that put me way behind. So rate of acquisition is affected by the type of educational program, whether or not and to what extent the development in a particular language is or is not interrupted, and the degree of language models and language development that can be fostered both at home and at school. So those factors, they're not difficult to look at. They're really very good. And, you know, I would look at a good example would be the Thomas Acquire data that I mentioned before, showing how when native language instruction is given so that children develop in what are called like simultaneous bilingual fashion rather than what are called sequential bilingual fashion, that those children actually outperform their monolingual native English-speaking peers, and they outperform all other ELLs in all other types of programs. So that shows you there's both a cognitive and academic benefit to being able to have native language instruction that does not interrupt the development that you bring in. And I think that's what's really key. Anything that facilitates that development is good to go. So high SES, well-educated parents, educational opportunities, native language instruction, et cetera.
Very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Did we cover everything, guys?
I think we did. We do have a lot of questions, but some of them include hopes for a part two with more discussion on the RTI.
Oh, okay. Ooh, we can go there. We can definitely go there.
Awesome.
That'd be great.
That would be.
Very cool. Yeah. Okay. As long as we got everybody. So yeah, if we didn't cover anything, like, type it now. Yeah. Very quickly. But I wanted to, again, thank you for coming on. And
yes.
It just always blows my mind when we do these podcasts. And, of course, we don't pay anybody. You know, and people like yourself just come and volunteer your time when you're so busy. And so thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, Rachel, Eric, and Rebecca. And, again, I'm glad we were able to discuss this issue, because it's a question that people have long had. And people don't realize, you know, as you were saying, Rachel, that – you know, the conclusions about, oh, chance levels and so on. Well, it's chance levels when you interpret the matrix backwards, okay, but not when you interpret it forward the way that it should be. And it's so confusing, you know, and I know that practitioners look at this stuff and it's probably all Greek to them, and I feel bad. And you know, I don't know. Again, I'm a pragmatist at heart. I want people to be able to do what they need to do, because they must do something. And again, I'm doing my best to give them what I can give them in terms of what the research says. You know, I didn't invent the fact that subtests are affected by culture and language. All right. It's not just my research that identified that. That's what the research is telling us. So, you know, the more I can get it out there in this kind of fashion, then, you know, I'm great. I'm happy to do it, because I want ELLs to get as fair a chance as they can. Because had I been evaluated, I believe, as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, you would have identified me as having a learning disability. You would have said, I can't write. And you would have been right. I couldn't write. And you would have said, oh, it's not English. Or I'm sorry, it's not English as a second language issues. He just has LD. And I would have believed you for my entire life. And yet I'm in a profession now where my job is to write. How did I get there, right, where suddenly the worst ability I ever had academically is now the best ability that I actually have? It's because I was never LD, because those issues were misunderstood. And I mean, that pains me. I know that English learners are being evaluated all the time. There's overrepresentation everywhere. And this is the way to deal with it. This is the way to begin addressing it. So I'm happy to help. I'll be happy to come back for part two and answer all the other questions as well. Or we'll talk about RTI. That's good too.
Very cool. And we had somebody who asked, you know, are you willing to take email questions?
Yes, but I cannot promise that I can answer, because very honestly, I get about 200 a day. And I mean, people send me case studies out of the blue sometimes. Please don't do that. You know, and then it's not like, you know, they give me all the data. They tell me what happened, what the thing is. And then they ask, what do you think? And it's not like I can go, oh, yeah, looks good to me. I mean, I have to write and it's hard. So I do not discourage you from emailing me if you would like. I just cannot promise that I will respond, but I will try my very best to do so. I will. I promise I will.
Awesome. Well, I'm even more thankful that you responded to my email to come and join us. You didn't get lost in all the emails.
That's right. Well, that's why I switched you over. All right.
All right. So I think we look pretty good. And so thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you, Dr. Ortiz. And I want to remind people that our next episode looks like 9-9, and we've got Dr. Reeves on for talking about school safety.
Yeah.
Another great topic. So.
Oh, wonderful.
All right. All right. Night, everybody. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Good night, everyone. Thank you. Bye-bye.